Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Wilmer Leon. Just ahead on News One Now, 7 families in Flint, Michigan have filed a class action lawsuit against city and state officials in the wake of Flint's water crisis. I'll chat with one of the attorneys who was leading the charge in their fight. White people have no idea what it's like to be poor. That is according to presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. Will the NFL reprimand an assistant coach for asking the wrong questions at this year's combine? The fight to bring down Mississippi's Confederate flag goes to court. Actress Amber Stevens West from The Carmichael Show stops by to talk about the new season. News One Now starts right now.
Should not be poisoned. Federal government comes in, federal government acts.
What is more important than the health and well-being of the people, particularly children? It is raining lead in Flint.
Finding solutions for the Flint water crisis was at the forefront during Sunday's Democratic debate. On Monday, 7 families in Flint found a solution of their own and joined forces to file a class action lawsuit against city and state officials claiming they were responsible for the city's water crisis and dishonest about the condition of the water residents consumed and used for bathing. I want to add some context to how many folks in Flint have been affected by this water crisis. The population in Flint is roughly 100,000. There are an estimated 8,000 lead pipelines that service these residents, all of which need to be replaced. These bad lead pipes have resulted in high blood levels in what experts estimate are between 6,000 and 12,000 children. Joining me now on Skype from New York City is one of the attorneys representing the 7 families in this lawsuit, Hunter Skolnick. Also here to weigh in on the panel, Carmen Berkeley, Civil, Human, and Women's Rights Director for the AFL-CIO, Dr. Avis Jones DeWeaver, Leadership Strategist for the Exceptional Leadership Institute for Women, and Andrew Lee, Republican Strategist. Yes,
Good morning, good morning.
There we go. Good morning, how are you?
Very good. How are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine. 7 families have filed a class action lawsuit. Please let us know where we are in this process.
We're very early on in the process. What we've just done is filed the lawsuit against the various officials responsible for supplying the water to the homes. Remember, the most important thing we have to look at here is that once lead is in these children, it's in them for life. And something has to be done in Flint, and something has to be done soon.
So is this a civil lawsuit that's been filed?
Yes, this is a civil lawsuit, meaning we're not seeking to put anyone in jail. It's not for criminal penalties, though I think the actions here rise to the level of criminal action. We're seeking compensation for the children, for the families, and we're also seeking money to replace the pipes into the homes, because until the pipes are fixed and changed, they're going to be exposed to lead for the future.
And how are you going to determine the amount of money being sought, since it's so difficult to determine how many children are being affected, the degree to which they're being affected, and how long that effect is going to last?
Unfortunately, these types of disasters are not new. Our law firm has experience with the post 9/11 first responders and the litigation there, where we represented over 6,000 people exposed to the chemicals in the toxic waste site. There is a way to quantify the damages for large groups of people. It's going to be very hard to look at each child, but we know the type of injury that they're going to be faced with over the course of their lives. And this has been done before, unfortunately, and we'll be able to do it here.
And seven families being classified as a class, but about how, do you have an idea about how many children at the end of this process will actually be included?
We think conservatively it's going to be in excess of 8,000 children. That has to be a minimum based upon the numbers that we're seeing today.
Pamela?
Yes, I have a question. There are some adults who, it seems, have died from this poisoning. Have you given any thought to perhaps also bringing wrongful death suits against the city and the state?
We are contemplating wrongful death suits. I understand there has been suits filed on behalf of Legionnaires' outbreak, which is also something associated with the bad water. We are also considering that, but we haven't filed that suit yet. And I'm not trying to downplay the effects to adults. We have plenty of clients who are adults who have been injured. We have miscarriages. This goes across the board, but the first step is the children, and we have to deal with the lead poisoning, which is such an insidious problem to children.
Hunter Skolnick from New York City, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
You know, listening to the debate and both Bernie Sanders and Senator Clinton talking about the governor needs to resign, and this is a civil lawsuit, somebody's got to go to prison behind
Absolutely.
This.
Absolutely. Several people have to go to prison behind this. You have dead people. You have children who will be impacted. Their brains are damaged for the rest of their lives. And this was a knowing action that not only occurred initially, but perpetuated despite the fact that the citizens were telling the government something's wrong with that water. In fact, they were lied to and told that everything's okay. There's criminality all over this. So while a civil suit, I agree, is appropriate, criminal action needs to quickly follow.
Andrew?
Yeah, this is a failure of government at all levels. I think that the response we've seen has been from the federal level to the state level. No one seems to know what's going on. The residents, as Dr. Weaver stated, have been talking about this for years, and it's been on deaf ears from Congress to the State House, to the State Department of Environment, Water Quality, to the EPA. Everyone keeps shifting the blame, but nothing is actually being done. And I actually think, you know, we might need to get the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in here to replace the pipes. I mean, Congress needs to authorize the funding. I know that there are several holdups right now, and they're still working out some of the details. I know Governor Snyder is set to testify. There's a lot of questions here, and it just seems that the administration keeps shifting blame.
I mean, really, I actually do think that we know what's going on. This is about environmental racism. This is about, you know, this happened with Katrina.
Yes.
Anytime there are large groups of Black people that are impacted by an environmental issue, all of a sudden, we don't understand politics. We don't understand what's happening in a community. If this was a white community, the entire nation would be up in arms. And I actually think that the organizing that's happening in the state of Michigan is incredible. But at the end of the day, voters need to hold these people accountable and get these people out of office that do not care about people of color and our ability to have clean water.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think it's sad that Flint has voted for Democrats for over 80 years, and this isn't necessarily a partisan issue, but I think this is indicative of what's happening across the country in urban areas where African-Americans and other groups were voting against our interests, were voting for people and not holding them accountable all the time. I know that the city went into receivership, and there's a lot going on with the governor trying to cut costs and clearly not trying to cut too much instead of actually doing what needed to be done to make sure that the water was clean and pure for
under a Republican governor. I mean, let's just be very clear about
that. I didn't understand the Democratic voting for Democrats part when the governor is Republican.
No, I'm trying to say that in a lot of cities and states across the country, we have Democratic governors, we have Democratic mayors. Violence is up. Crime is up. I think Flint is indicative. Like I said, there are 19 places in Pennsylvania that have higher water levels, higher lead levels than Flint does. In New York, it's
but the Democratic mayor actually on this show, the Democratic mayor said that she had been trying to tell the governor and the government of Michigan that something was happening. So to me, you're right. It's not even about being partisan, but I don't think it's a matter of, you know, the Democratic mayor versus the Republican governor. I think it's a matter of when something happens to Black people, all of a sudden the entire nation gets amnesia.
Yeah, but I'm just my only point is that stuff has been happening to Black people for a long time, and there are Black people in charge, and nothing is changing.
Well, there's another big issue that is coming out of the recent debate. Presidential candidate Bernie Sanders is definitely feeling the burn after his response about racial blind spots during the Democratic presidential debate in Flint on Sunday.
Young lady comes up to me and she says, "You don't understand what police do in certain black communities. You don't understand the degree to which we are terrorized." And I'm not just shooting, I'm not just talking about the horrible shootings that we have seen, which have got to end, and we've got to hold police officers accountable. I'm just talking about everyday activities where police officers are bullying people. So what, to answer your question, I would say, and I think it's similar to what the secretary said, when you're white, you don't know what it's like to be living in a ghetto. You don't know what it's like to be poor. You don't know what it's like to be hassled when you walk down the street or you get dragged out of a car. And I believe that as a nation in the year 2016, we must be firm in making it clear we will end institutional racism and reform a broken criminal justice system.
That was very interesting. I think a lot of this is really a distraction. But in listening to Bernie Sanders, there were a number of things that jumped out at me that I really haven't heard a lot of people discussing. And the first is he refers to himself as white. Watch this.
When you're white, you don't know what it's like to be living in a ghetto. You don't know what it's like to be poor. You don't know what it's like to be hassled when you walk down the street or you get dragged out of a car.
He says also during the debate that being Jewish is to his core. Mm-hmm. But in this instance, he says, when you're white, which to me gets to the crux of racism in this country, because he is the son of Polish immigrant parents. And one of the very interesting things is how Europeans from whatever nationality they are, Italians, Greeks, mm-hmm. Irish, came to this country, were at the bottom of the economic ladder, primarily for labor reasons. They're able to move beyond that and assimilate into mainstream America because they're white. Mm-hmm. We haven't had that option.
No.
The second thing that I found very interesting is that he used the term ghetto and that white people don't know what it's like to live in the ghetto. But when you look at, again, he's born in 1941 in Brooklyn. Chances are, being Jewish, he lived in a ghetto, since the European definition of ghetto is a place where Jewish people live. So I found this, I found a lot of, for me anyway, a lot of very interesting nuances to what Bernie was saying. And at the end of the day, what this says to me is that for as progressive as Bernie Sanders is, mm-hmm. he still doesn't get it.
But he's also from, and I'm not making excuses for Bernie, this is also not an endorsement, he is a white man from Vermont. So there are some things that I expect from Bernie. I'm happy he actually said, I am not black. You all do not mm-hmm. understand what it means to be black. But I will say this, Bernie was wrong for saying ghetto. He shouldn't use that term ever. But at least the Democrats are saying the word black, talking about black things. When I'm listening to these Republican debates, they're not even talking about our issues. So I'll deal with Bernie's gaffe if
Absolutely.
It means that he's talking about our issues.
And he got to the right place at the end of the statement by saying we have to do away with institutionalized racism in the country. So
I don't think that being able to do away with racism, given like how he feels about the issue. I mean, I get what you're saying about the Republican Party or like the Republican debates and that they're not addressing some of these issues. I think they are. I think if you look at what Speaker Ryan is doing with poverty reform, there's a lot that
they don't even say black. They don't even say, like, black people, African-American.
Have they even said the word poverty during the debates? Have the Republicans even used the word poverty?
They're over here hailing the Donald Trump. I mean, I don't think they're talking
mine's
about poverty.
Yours.
Yeah.
Let's just be real. The Republican debates have just devolved down to a C-class middle school debate team that is just fixated on crudeness. But the reality is about Bernie's statement. His problem to me just really illustrates his inability to extricate race out of this issue of class.
Yes.
He is completely focused on class, so much so that he can't see that Trayvon wasn't killed in a ghetto,
exactly.
That Sandra Bland didn't die in a ghetto, that perfectly,
President Obama, as a senator, has been unable to get a cab, in the city.
Exactly. People that come with the best
pedigree. That's a common mistake.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Can't ascend up the career ladder to the same degree that people with less qualifications can who don the cover of whiteness. Okay? And so his inability to understand that in a very authentic way, mm-hmm. it's troublesome to me. He needs to get it, and everything does not boil down to Wall Street. That's what he doesn't get.
And that has a lot to do with why that's one of the reasons why a lot of people in the community are having difficulty moving over to Bernie, because, and he's not alone in this, and to his credit, he says, we don't get it.
Right.
And he demonstrated clearly.
But I think that Secretary Clinton has work to do, too. I mean, the black community knows Secretary Clinton. And
yes.
So, the black community is leaning into Secretary Clinton. But she needs to learn how to talk to black women. She needs to learn how to talk to black men as well if she's going to get this nomination.
How do you look at this as a Republican strategist? I'm trying to find where is the outrage that amidst all that's going on in this country right now in the African-American community, these issues are not being discussed during the Republican debates.
I do think that they're being discussed, though, in the halls of Congress. I think they're being discussed in state houses across the country. I think that
during the Republican debate, because right now people are trying to determine who the next president is going to be.
And
if the Republican Party isn't putting these issues out in the forefront as they talk about looking or trying to find additional outreach, mm-hmm. who are they reaching out to and how are they doing?
Well, I would say that we have a very difficult situation on our hands, right? So everyone thinks that Trump is going to be the nominee. It's not done yet. Right.
Feels done.
It might feel, but I think I really do.
Stick a fork in it.
No, I really believe that's a media narrative. I mean, I think that next week we'll see. Next week.
Florida's key.
Right. Florida,
key.
Michigan, Ohio. Right. But I mean, just from the delegate
If Lil Marco can't win Florida.
Okay.
Well,
every week they say, oh, Donald Trump. Okay. But if he wins this state, maybe he's won all the states.
He won't win a majority of the delegates if he does not wipe the slate clean next week. So that's a reality. We'll go into a broker convention and we'll be able to have.
But Republicans still ain't talking about our issues.
That's the point. They're still not talking about our issues, no matter how much outreach they claim.
I want them to say black.
They are trying to employ.
Well, maybe
coming up, the NFL is back in hot water due to a controversial question at this year's combine. The battle with the Confederate flag continues. We'll hear from a lawyer who is suing the Mississippi governor to take down the state's Confederate flag. The Carmichael Show, Amber Stevens West, is in the house to talk about season 2 premiere. It is 18 past the hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm Roland Martin. News 1 Now heads to Ohio to talk to Secretary Hillary Clinton and Senator Bernie Sanders. The CNN TV 1 Ohio Democratic Presidential Town Hall, Sunday at 8 p.m. right here on TV 1.
Eli Apple, a former Ohio State cornerback, was asked a different type of question.
I've been asked a lot of weird questions. I don't know if I could say them on TV. I think the Falcons coach, one of the coaches was like, so do you like men? And it was like the first thing he asked me.
Really?
It was weird. And I was just like, no. I'm just like, well, if you're going to come to Atlanta, you just got to know that, sometimes that's how it is out here or whatever. You got to get used to it. And I guess he was joking, but I guess they just ask most of these questions to see how you're going to react.
How you react, right.
If you're paying attention, I guess. And that was like the first thing off the bat.
As you can see, Eli Apple wasn't quite sure how to deal with that question. Is the NFL still homophobic? Is this an issue that we should really at this point be concerned about?
Well, in 2016, nobody should be asking anyone's sexual identity or gender identity at their job, because at the end of the day, this is what this gentleman does as a profession. And so, you know, at least for me, as somebody that works for workers' rights, we have to protect the rights of people to be able to be gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender when they're in the workplace. So to me, I'm happy that the coach ended up apologizing. But in 2016, we know that that's an inappropriate question to be asking.
Let's do this. Let's go to the apology, and then I'll let you two respond. Offense people have taken to it. In 2016, what would prompt someone to ask something as ridiculous as that? Andrew?
I mean, I just think it's inappropriate. I think that for us to, in 2016, to be defined by our sexuality or our race and all these other things, it's just, it's not what our country stands for. That's, I agree with Carmen. You know, you go to work to do a job, you don't go to work to fit in the people's preconceived notions of what you should be or shouldn't be.
Avis, as a leadership strategist, what does this say about the organization?
It's horrible. You know, really, seriously, this could open up the NFL to a lawsuit. Yeah. You know, I would be wondering if that gentleman is, you know, if he really wanted to, he could take it there. And knowing that coming off the heels of having a previously out NFL player basically being, I would call it, drummed out of the league, this is the last thing you want to do, just plain and simple PR purposes, besides the fact that it's the wrong thing to do. And in terms of leadership, it absolutely shows a derelict of duty that unfortunately seems to be habitual in the NFL.
It has to be because of the how he responded even in the clip. Was, you know, he was laughing about it, almost like this is a joke. And, you know, the fact that that's the culture within the NFL, it needs to be called to question.
Well, I don't know about how he responded because college kid put in a very, very uncomfortable situation. What I took from that was he was incredibly uncomfortable being put in the situation, and he's incredibly uncomfortable now.
Yeah. Right, right.
Yeah.
Wow, it's you just have to wonder. Well, I guess stupid is what stupid does,
yep.
but there's no place in the workplace
no.
For questions like you're going to Atlanta. Do you like men?
What does that have to do with anything? Nothing. Can I play football? Can I win?
Exactly. Well, when we come out of this break, or coming up, we're going to hear from a lawyer who is suing the Mississippi governor to take down the state's Confederate flag. Actress Amber Stevens is here to talk about the latest season of The Carmichael Show. For the latest news, stay up to date and informed at news1.com. Hit me up with your thoughts on Twitter at Dr. W. Leon or News1 on our News1 Facebook page. It's 24 past the hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
The ongoing Confederate flag controversy has made its way to the courts of Mississippi. Attorney Carlos Moore has filed a federal lawsuit against Governor Phil Bryant to strip the Mississippi flag of the Confederate symbol. The suit claims the flag promotes hostility and acts of violence against people of color, and therefore violates the Equal Protection and Due Process Clauses of the 14th Amendment. The suit was filed just days after Governor Bryant proclaimed April to be Confederate Heritage Month. Attorney Moore joins us now on Skype from Jackson, Mississippi. Attorney Moore, welcome, and thanks for coming on board.
Thanks for having me.
You and other leaders like Pastor Jamal Bryant are preparing for a rally in Jackson at 12 o'clock this afternoon in an effort to bring pressure to take down the flag. Talk to us about the rally and talk to us about the lawsuit.
Yes, Pastor Jamal Bryant and others will be with me today at noon on the steps of the state capitol. We will be declaring to
Governor
Bryant that his time is a change, it's time for a revolution. And we will proclaim that it is time to make a change in Mississippi. It's past time. I'm doing it for my daughter. We want to see that flag come down, and we have filed a lawsuit in the federal courts because we believe historically the federal courts have been the only place that we could get relief in Mississippi in the area of civil rights.
What kind of pushback are you getting within the state of Mississippi itself?
Well, the governor thinks it's a frivolous lawsuit, and I'm getting a groundswell of support from a cross-section of the community in Mississippi. We have the African-Americans and progressive whites that are on my side, and we expect to see that today at the rally. You will see a cross-section of the community there, and we are just excited to take this step on behalf of the next generation.
On the heels of what transpired in South Carolina, I'm shocked that Mississippi would dig their heels in and put up such opposition, because obviously they're on the losing side of history. They're on the losing side of the argument.
That's correct. It surprises me. I cannot fathom a reasonable explanation for why Mississippi takes the stance that it does. The sad situation in South Carolina in June did not even warrant the governor to issue an executive order to fly the flags at half staff. Yesterday, he issued an executive order to fly the stacks at half.
So, talk to us a little bit. What do you all think? Here we are again. It's not even a year since the flag came down in South Carolina, and now we're in Mississippi.
Yeah, I mean, the Confederate flag belongs in a museum. I mean, I grew up in the South. Everyone who's black in the South knows what the Confederate flag means. It's a battle emblem. It's a symbol of hate and division. It has no place on top of our state grounds. I mean, to defend it, I think, is unconscionable, and it speaks to a lot of the issues that we were talking about earlier about parties reaching out to people or you're not just elected for the people that voted for you, you're elected for the entire state.
But you have to remember, in South Carolina, they didn't take that flag down because it was the right thing to do.
Oh, right.
People have been organizing around that for decades. Sure. They took it down because 9 people were murdered inside of a church, mm-hmm. inside of Mother Emanuel Church. So to me, I feel like, you know, as a community, at some point we have to say enough is enough, because I can't even wear my Black Lives Matter pin through the airport without people looking at me like I have 14 heads. So why is it okay for our nation to still be flying a flag that has a symbol of hate all across it?
Avis?
Well, that's the thing. That to me is indicative of what it means to live in a culture that still holds on to white supremacy. This is a symbol of white supremacy. No matter how people try to rewrite the history, no matter the fact that we continue to, as a nation, deny our true past and deny the presence of racism. And it is this sort of dual reality where we live in a situation where people on one hand will cling to the rebel flag as a symbol of heritage, yet throw up tantrum around dancers at the Super Bowl donning outfits that look like and represent the Black Panthers. It shows to me that this nation is still immature. It is still sort of deep and steeped in racism. And this is just one other example of what we need to do in order to call it out and to purge it out of this nation for good.
I think Attorney Carlos Mori is back. Carlos, are you with us?
I am.
There we go. You know, Dr. DeWeaver's point about Beyonce and the outrage over her performance at the Super Bowl, where many believe that she was paying homage or paying respect to the Panthers, who were actually doing nothing more than defending our interests in this country. And we have the governor of Mississippi proclaiming April to be Confederate Heritage Month, when all the Confederacy was about was destroying our culture and our interests. In 2016, we're still having these conversations. Let me ask you this. Do you think that it's an accident that we're in a 2016 presidential debate and you have the governor of Mississippi declaring April Confederate Heritage Month?
It's not an accident at all. It's very intentional. The governor did it within Black History Month to proclaim April as Confederate Heritage Month. He did it as an insult to the African-American people in Mississippi, and that was the last straw that broke the camel's back. I immediately filed a lawsuit against him to take that flag down. We are not playing in Mississippi. That flag must come down.
And how likely do you think, what are your chances of success here?
I take courage in the fact that President Obama is the one who appointed the judge who will be making this decision. Judge Carlton Reeves, he is a Jackson State University graduate. He also went to the University of Virginia Law School. He's a learned jurist, and I take courage in knowing that he will do his due diligence, study the law, and I believe at the end of the day, he will order that flag be taken down.
Avis?
I just first of all want to thank you for having the courage to file this suit. I think this was a bold action. We know that Mississippi still, in many respects, can be a very violent place. And I'm wondering, do you have any fear of your safety? Have you heard any pushback as a result of filing this lawsuit?
There has been some pushback, but I am not fearful. I am confident that this is God ordained, and we're going to go forth, and we are going to get that flag down in 2016.
Well, Attorney Carlos Moore, thank you so much for your work. Thank you so much for your efforts. And please, we're going to follow this and keep us posted as this whole thing develops.
I will. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, it's an interesting point that Attorney Moore makes in terms of who appointed the judge and where the judge went to school, because that takes me into the whole conversation about the Supreme Court.
Yes.
And I was listening to Chuck Grassley yesterday try to rationalize why President Obama should not be allowed to nominate a Supreme Court justice, and I was left with one question. Has Chuck Grassley lost his mind?
Yeah, they just don't want us to be great. They don't want President Obama to be great. They don't want black people to be great. Thank goodness President Obama has a law degree and understands how government is supposed to work, but that's the reason why they're freaking out, because we will end up with situations like we will in Mississippi where the flag will have to come down because we have a good judicial system with people inside of it that understand our issues.
One of the things that I've heard not only Chuck Grassley say, but I've heard Mitch McConnell say, is the people need to decide. But last I checked, Senator Barack Obama was democratically elected in 2004, and I'm sorry, in 2008, and reelected
in 2012.
Mm-hmm. I think the people spoke.
They spoke
and spoke
loud.
Clearly.
They spoke loud and clear. And the thing is, they're talking to these low information voters that Donald Trump likes so much. Mm-hmm. They're just making it up.
As he says, I love uneducated people.
Exactly, exactly. So they're just making it up as they go along, trying to delay in the hopes that whoever they decide to nominate ends up in the White House. But the bottom line is, they can keep on pushing this down the road, and it's just going to make them look completely like the obstructionists that they've always been, which at the end of the day is going to come back to bite them, I predict, when we go to a general election.
Andrew?
I just think that at a minimum, we should have a vote. You know?
On what?
No, like on the nominee. I think that the president should submit.
Based on what?
No, a Supreme Court nominee. I'm saying that the process, we should, the president should nominate a justice.
Oh, I'm sorry.
See, you're so used to trying to come for me. You know, you just are like, No.
I'm sorry. No, I was still on in the context of that the people should speak. Right. That's, I'm sorry. So, I apologize.
So, likewise, the president should nominate a justice.
Yes.
We should have hearings. We should go through the process. They should get an up or down vote. I mean, I think anything beyond that is obstruction and dereliction of duty, and that we have a constitutional responsibility, the House and Senate, well, Senate in this case, to confirm a justice or to at least have hearings on a justice.
It's amazing to me that there's not more outrage from journalists in mainstream media.
I don't think people know what's at stake.
Or understand the implications of not having a full Supreme Court.
So that's the White House's fault.
It's not amazing to me that it's no outrage from the journalists. And I'll tell you why. To me, true journalism is, for the most part, dead. We have a journalistic machine now that is required to put on shows 24/7,
AKA Donald
ending,
Trump.
Yeah. Exactly, a non-ending news cycle, which is why we have the circus around Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And the reality is, they've taken on this different approach to reporting the news, which is this false equivalency. Okay, we'll have person A on who says this. We have person B on who says that. Forget the fact that person B is lying. Mm-hmm. Forget the fact that person B is inaccurate. You decide. That's what passes as journalism today. I would argue that that's not journalism. And unfortunately, that is going forward in miseducating the American public and playing to that low information voter.
And also the fact that person A is a strategist from one side, person B is a strategist from the other side. And so all you're going to get from A and B are the talking points from their selective sides. And rarely do you get substantive analysis of the positions so that people can understand really exactly what is at stake. I mean, when you listen to Grassley, when you listen to McConnell, there is A, no historical precedents to support their position.
Absolutely not.
There is no constitutional context to support their positions. They are just totally, totally off base.
And really, at the end of the day, this isn't about necessarily nominating anybody. It's about what's in the Supreme Court right now.
Yes.
What's in the Supreme Court are workers' rights issues, Friedrichs, abortion, affirmative action, issues that they know if President Obama puts someone in, all these issues that the progressives and the Democrats care about are going to get passed through the Supreme Court. That is what's at stake right now.
Bingo.
Bingo, bingo. Let's move on to the next phase. Coming up, find out how one of the last black boarding schools in America plans to launch a robotics program. The Carmichael Show, Amber Stevens West is here to talk about the season 2 premiere. For the latest news, stay up to date and informed at news1.com. Hit me up with your thoughts on Twitter at Dr. W. Leon or at News1 on our News1 Facebook page. It's 41 past the hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
The historic Piney Woods School is one of only 3 African-American boarding schools left in the country, and it has a special link with TV One. It was started in 1909 by Lawrence C. Jones, the grandfather of Kathy Hughes, the founder of this station. Today, Piney Woods is known for its college prep academics and is looking to launch a coding and robotics program to further prepare its students for the future. Guest host Laura Coates recently spoke with Piney Woods president Will Crossley to find out more.
I'm a proud alumnus and pleased to be able to serve the school now as the head of the institution. Piney Woods did an extraordinary job for me, who I'd grown up on the south side of Chicago. I had a chance to go to this school and was able to have both educational and professional success, I think, after that. And so our hope, our goal is to do that for more and more kids.
And one of the things you're doing now is trying to have a robotics program based on STEM, the science, technology, engineering, and math programs. Is that right?
The core of who we are as a school is the same. We began as a school that was about the whole child. How do we do that? And really what we're doing with our STEM work, we started with robotics because we're really interested in continuing an experiential learning opportunity for our kids. And with robotics, they can get their hands on in the educational process.
And so, you write about how you want to educate the mind, the heart, and the hands.
Right.
And the robotics program does that. Tell me about it.
Right. Absolutely. And our kids have had amazing success. Head, heart, and hands is what we do as an institution. At one point in time, that meant farming. And we still have a farm today, but it's not what it means for us today. And we really wanted to do a 21st century look at what our kids need to be doing. They're great problem solvers, brilliant kids. Our robotics program, just in a year and a half, has had amazing success. We just came back from a regional competition in which we took first place in every category. And so our kids are just performing amazingly well.
Now, what is a robotics program? Is it something you're building, crafting a robot? Are you trying to make sure you can manipulate it? Is it coding? What is it?
Yeah, well, it's a mix of all those things. At its core, it's problem solving, right? It's mathematics. At its core, it's logic. But you do it with manipulatives. We order kits that the kids use and put together, but then they have to tell those robots what to do. And so they're involved in that coding process, they're involved in that problem-solving process, and we think it's really foundational, and it's something our kids connect with. As much as kids connect today with video games and all those other things, things that we complain about. Mm-hmm. We can really do this in a much more productive fashion for our kids, and that's one of the things we're trying to do at Piney Woods.
I love that it's a problem-solving kids, because it allows children to feel like they can fail in a safe environment, yeah, and also overcome that failure and be more productive. And that's one of the things that's a core at Piney Woods, isn't it?
Well, it's a big piece of who we are. We're all about place-based education. We're in rural Mississippi, and some have criticized us for that. The beauty of that, I came from the south side of Chicago. We have kids from over 20 states across the country, everywhere from here, in Washington, D.C., to south central Los Angeles, to the Bronx.
My husband's from the Bronx. I got to shout it out.
And so we have kids who come from all of, but we're insulated in the thick pine forestry of this country. And in that space, our kids can be themselves. They have the safety to fail and the support system so that they can get back up and go at it again. And then our graduates go out and do amazingly well.
And as you said, they don't just fail. These are students who are thriving. They're winning national competitions. And over 90% of your students go on to college and higher.
It's not about failing. It's about getting back up. And so our kids learn how to, adjust from the mistakes that they make. And yes, they go on and do amazingly well. 97% of our kids admitted into post-secondary education or training. We have students on scholarships at colleges all over this country. Our kids, we not only make education financially attainable, but we also make it academically accessible for our kids. In the last 3 years, our kids have earned over $3 million, our graduating seniors, in scholarship support from higher education institutions across the country. So we're very proud of that.
That's amazing. You're also proud that they actually had an invitation from the White House. Is that right? Tell me about that.
We did. And so we have a world-renowned choir that has had an opportunity to perform all over the world, from South Africa, and then all over this country. And on this past December, our young people received an invitation to come to the White House and perform at a annual Christmas party that the President and First Lady held. They actually got an opportunity to do a private performance for the President and the First Lady of the United States. And so it was just an amazing, amazing opportunity for our kids. And we're so fortunate they were able to do that. I, in fact, have been an appointee, a presidential appointee in the administration before I took this role. And so to be able to bring the kids into this world of Washington, D.C. and connect them. Our kids are now doing other things in D.C. We have a summer internship program where our kids came in this past summer. Our kids got a chance to meet Supreme Court justices, a chance to go to the White House, to go to the Congress, to go to embassies and really understand public service in a real way.
Well, let's keep the trajectory going for your students. How do we give funding or donations for the robotics program to ensure they're prepared in the STEM world?
Sure. Well, folks can contribute to us. One of the things we try to make clear at Piney Woods is that we will not turn away a student for an inability to pay. All of our students receive scholarship support. People can contribute to that on our website at www.pineywoods.org. And there's a donate now button there. We'd ask more and more people to go and help us support our kids.
Oh, wave. No, not yet. Actress Amber Stevens West joins us live in the studio to talk about the Carmichael Show. It's 50 past the hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
NBC's The Carmichael Show has quickly become a fan favorite since its debut this past summer. The sitcom became the most watched summer comedy on network TV in 8 years.
Well, it just so happens that I am uniquely qualified to give advice on exactly this topic.
Really?
Yes, I have been in a relationship that involved cheating, and it was a lot to go through, but I ended up getting through it, and it was a great learning experience for me. And I think that Karen will feel the same way, and she will thank you for your honesty.
Maxine, what do you mean you were in a relationship that involved cheating? Like, you were cheated on?
No.
Are you a homewrecker?
As you can see, the show boasts an impressive cast, including David Alan Greer, Loretta Devine, Gerard Carmichael, and Amber Stevens West, who joins me live in the studio to discuss season two.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And listening to, or watching you watch yourself and then laugh at yourself.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird to see yourself on TV.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, you would know.
Yes, it is. So, season two, talk about the comeback and what's the focus of this season and particularly, what's up for your character?
Yeah, so we're so happy to be back. I mean, we had this really small 6-episode season over the summer, and it did so well, it really surprised everybody, and we're so happy to be doing more of the same thing, because what we focus on our show is conversations. So every episode is about like one specific topic, and then the cast kind of just discusses the topic. The whole show is like honest conversations that people are really having in their living rooms mm-hmm. across America. So, you know, Maxine, my character, is the kind of very open-minded, kind of liberal point of view in the conversation. And then we've got the parents who have their, you know, more conservative point
David
of
Alan
view.
Greer definitely yes. comes across conservative.
Yes, certainly. So it's just a really fun, like, balanced, honest conversation that we get to have every week, and I think it's a lot of fun.
What type of response have you been getting, not from critics or whatnot, but just as you're out and about and people recognize Maxine walking down the street or in an elevator, or you know, what kind of response are you getting?
A really positive response. People love the show, and it's still fun. It's still weird to get recognized from the show because we had such a small little, you know, 6-episode first season, and so when people say they've seen it, it's almost still shocking to me. But it's been super well received. I mean, people like jump to meet me. Like, they come running up to me like, oh my god, I have to meet you. It's the Carmichael Show, because they feel like it's an undiscovered mm-hmm. thing that like only they know about. But they seem to really love it, and they seem to be excited for more.
How much input, since you say it's a conversational format
yeah.
and that the characters carry on the conversation and the dialogue. So how much input do you have in terms of how that conversation actually flows?
I personally don't have that much input, but I would definitely say my character is a lot like myself. I think my personality influences what the writers go ahead and write. Because my character is basically the only person not based on a real person. The show really is about Gerard's real life. His parents are based on his real parents. His brother's based on his real brother. But this girlfriend is a made-up character. So, you know, when we did the first season, Gerard and Ari, one of our other show creators, took me out to dinner, and they just wanted to ask me a bunch of questions about how I view the world and what I see and things. And so I am a lot like my character.
You're going to be discussing some very, very heavy topics this coming season, mm-hmm. cheating, abortion, gentrification, and Muslims.
Yes.
How do you tackle that discussion and keep it light and humorous?
And make it funny. I know, that's so funny. When I have to describe to people what the show's about, I tell them what we talk about. I'm like, but it's funny, I promise. Really, it's just the honesty of the conversations, which is what's so fun. And because it's a family dynamic, you can be as brutally honest as you want to be when you're with your family. And so we're just doing that. That's all we're doing. And I think that's what makes it relatable and fun and funny, is that you can say the craziest thing that's on your mind when you're with your own family, and then to be a viewer from the outside watching what you're really thinking or what your own family has said back at home is what you relate to and why it's so humorous.
So if you had three simple things to tell the audience about why they have to watch the Carmichael Show,
okay.
what would be the three things? Look in the camera and tell which one. I don't know. Hey, you're the actress.
One. Well, I don't do the news. There's not all these cameras at my job. Okay. The Carmichael Show is smart, it's witty, and it's a lot of fun. I would definitely say our show, we focus on really hard topics, but it's a really open, big conversation, and we're not skewed towards one point of view. We're going to show it all, and so I hope you guys like it. Please watch it.
Actress Amber Stevens West, The Carmichael Show. Yeah. Oh, when is it on? Give us
Sunday nights.
Sunday nights.
Sunday nights. So
check your local listing.
Yes.
Sunday nights, check your local listing.
Yes.
I'm Dr. Wilmer Leon, and this is News One Now. We'll be right back.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV.
It's birthday shout-out time. Retired basketball player and sportscaster Kenny the Jet Smith turns 51. Actor Leon Robinson turns 54. And NBC anchor Lester Holt, from Sacramento, by the way, turns 57. On this day in history, in 1876, the U.S. Senate votes to deny PBS Pinchback a seat. In 1945, Phyllis Mae Daly becomes U.S. Navy's first African-American nurse. In 1977, Henry L. Marsh III is elected the first black mayor of Richmond, Virginia. Tomorrow on News One Now, continuing coverage of the presidential primaries. Courtney Vance talks about his role as Johnny Cochran on the FX series The People versus O.J. Simpson. And Roland, it is his show. And Roland brings the funny with the Wild and Out Wednesday comedians. You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. W. Leon. Also, you can friend the show on the News One Facebook page. Go to newsone.com for the latest on the stories you care about. Thank you for watching. Have a great day.
First step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin.